Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Kanamane. Namaste Saraswati Devam Gauravani Bacharne Nirvishesha Shunyavari Paschacha Dishitarne. Can everyone hear okay? Is this loud enough? Seems like could use a little more. Okay. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 We're going to read from the Bhagavad Gita today, chapter 2, verse 46. I'll just read it then. Yavanartha udapane sarvata samputo dike tavan sarveshu vedeshu brahmanasya vijnanata. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. All purposes served by a small well can at once be served by a great reservoir of water. Similarly, all the purposes of the Vedas can be served by one who knows the purpose behind them. Purport. The rituals and sacrifices mentioned in the Karmakanda division of the Vedic literature are meant to encourage gradual development of self-realization. And the purpose of self-realization is clearly stated in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, 15:15. The purpose of studying the Vedas is to know Lord Krishna, the primeval cause of everything. So self-realization means understanding Krishna and one's eternal relationship with Him. The relationship of the living entities with Krishna is also mentioned in the 15th chapter, 15:7. The living entities are part and parcel of Krishna, and therefore revival of Krishna consciousness by the individual living entity is the highest perfectional stage of Vedic knowledge. This is confirmed in the Srimad Bhagavatam 3.33.7 as follows. Aho bhattasva pacho tukariyan yajigvagre vartate namatubhyam te pus tapaste juhuvu sasnur arya brahmanuchur namagrinanti ete. O my Lord, a person who is chanting your holy name, although born of a low family like that of a chandala, dog-eater, is situated on the highest platform of self-realization. Such a person must have performed all kinds of penances and sacrifices according to Vedic rituals and studied the Vedic literatures many, many times after taking his bath in all the holy places of pilgrimage. So one must be intelligent enough to understand the purpose of the Vedas without being attached to the rituals only, and must not desire to be elevated to the heavenly kingdoms for a better quality of sense gratification. It is not possible for the common man in this age to follow all the rules and regulations of the Vedic rituals, nor is it possible to study all of the Vedanta and Upanishads thoroughly. It requires much time, energy, knowledge, and resources to execute the purposes of the Vedas. This is hardly possible in this age. The best purpose of Vedic culture is served, however, by chanting the holy name of the Lord, as recommended by Lord Chaitanya, the deliverer of all fallen souls. When Lord Chaitanya was asked by a great Vedic scholar, Pakashananda Saraswati, why he, the Lord, was chanting the holy name of the Lord like a sentimentalist instead of studying Vedanta philosophy, the Lord replied that his spiritual master had found him to be a great fool and thus asked him to chant the holy name of Lord Krishna. Of course, don't misunderstand, Lord Chaitanya was not a great fool. He was simply taking the part of an ordinary person. He did so and became ecstatic like a madman. In this age of Kali, most of the population is foolish and not adequately educated to understand Vedanta philosophy. The best purpose of Vedanta philosophy is served by inoffensively chanting the holy name of the Lord. Vedanta is the last word in Vedic wisdom, and the author and the knower of Vedanta philosophy is Lord Krishna. And the highest Vedantist is the great soul who takes pleasure in chanting the holy name of the Lord. This is the ultimate purpose of all Vedic mysticism. Om Gyanati Panandisha Gyanajana Salakaya Chakshurni Samina Tasma Sri Gurave Namaha. Panchakalpatarubhischa Kripasindhavyebhischa Patitano Pavanebhyo Vaishnavyebhyo Namo Namaha. So, thank you all for being here on this sort of somewhat rainy Sunday afternoon. This is actually a very nice verse and very wonderful purport of Srila Prabhupada, because he discusses the power and the purpose of the holy name of the Lord. There's a nice quote that Srila Prabhupada gives from the Srimad Bhagavatam, third canto, in this purport, where he says that the verse says that one who is born in a low family is situated on the highest platform of chanting Krishna's holy name. So amongst the many benefits and attributes of the holy name that are being glorified here, the first one is that it's readily accessible to everyone. This is one of the great advantages of the Sankirtan Yajna, which is actually the process of self-realization for this age. It is meant for everyone. Everyone can take this up. And we saw this very clearly. This is not just some hyperbole or something that it's stated as a flowery verse, that the lowest people can become elevated to this platform of Krishna consciousness simply by chanting, because we have that experience. When Srila Prabhupada came to the Western countries, everybody was involved in the most abominable activities. Most of us were not very interested in spiritual life, or if we were, we didn't really know what it was. The culture that Prabhupada found himself in the Lower East Side of New York and in Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco, was filled with a culture of drugs, illicit sex, and then the whole country was involved in rampant materialism. Everybody was simply interested in sense gratification. They had no understanding of higher spiritual principles of self-realization. But Prabhupada came into this situation, into this very fallen culture, and he gave this Vedanta philosophy. And of course, the essence of it was the holy name. And the result was that so many people in these Western countries, not only in America, but countries throughout the world, became devotees, became Vaishnavas, became followers of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and took to the process of service to the Lord. One reporter asked Srila Prabhupada if he could perform miracles, because many holy men would come from India, and they would do different tricks. There was one, Sai Baba was popular during that time, and he would do these different little tricks and miracles, and different things would happen. And Prabhupada said, he pointed to his disciples, he says, I have performed the greatest miracle. I have turned these hippies into Vaishnavas, devotees of the Lord. So indeed that was a great miracle that Srila Prabhupada did. He didn't just perform tricks or, have some sort of, popular performance that he would do for his audience. But he actually changed the hearts of people. He changed the minds. He changed our consciousness and brought us to real spiritual life. And of course, this is the purpose of the guru. This is what the spiritual master does. He brings the bona fide process of spiritual life to his followers. So in any process of self-realization, there needs to be some process of purification. In other words, every spiritual path has a practice. You have to do something. Now, chanting the holy name of the Lord is not very difficult in itself, but still there is some practice that must be there. And, of course, that's what Prabhupada is describing in this purport, that there were so many practices of self-realization that may be mentioned in the Vedas, but they may not be appropriate for this age. People simply cannot do the same type of activities that they might have been able to do in former ages. So even the Bhagavad Gita describes the process of karma yoga, jnana yoga, the process of meditation, the process of yoga. All of these things are there, the process of jnana. All of this is there, and these are bona fide paths to self-realization. But they're very difficult in this age of Kali. For instance, how many people can really study deeply this Vedanta philosophy, everything that is there, and through intellectual abilities be able to discern the difference between spirit and matter and come to a conclusion that one is not the body, that one is a spirit soul, and take up a process of devotion? This is very difficult through just a mental or intellectual process. It has to be a process through the heart. So that does not work so well for those of us in this Kali Yuga, in this particular age. We don't have the minds, the memories, the sharpness of intellect for this. Also, one must be very careful that one may be given different processes that may not really be practical. Ashtanga Yoga is actually a bona fide process, the Eightfold Path of Yoga, which was given by Patanjali in the scriptures thousands and thousands of years ago. But nobody can really perform this. It's a very difficult eightfold process. So now it's popular. Someone say, I'm performing Ashtanga Yoga. That means they're sitting quietly and trying to meditate or trying to clear their mind or something. This is like the most beginning rudimentary process and hardly is the real process that's there in the ancient scriptures. So many of these paths people may try, but they really, really will not work and not be practical. In the past, in past ages, thousands of years ago, people could perform great sacrifices. Nobody can do this. Nobody can perform this. We don't have the qualified Brahmins. We don't have the ingredients. I heard sometime a few years ago, I may have mentioned this once, I don't know if anybody heard, this was like probably about 20 years ago, but there was some supposed Swami or something from India, and he was saying how we should perform Agnihotra, which is fire sacrifice, which is similar. But he said, but it is difficult for people to perform Agnihotra. So he was giving people what he called Chota Agnihotra. Chota means little. So you had a little piece of one of those things that burn. You light them. It's like a little charcoal, and then you put some incense and you put some incense there. So you could do this in your ashtray in your car. You could have your little mini Agnihotra, mini fire sacrifice you could do in your ashtray, or you could do on your counter in your house like that. This may be fun for people, but it's certainly not going to give them self-realization. It's not going to have the result. Most people want a very easy path. We live in an age of instant gratification. Everybody wants things immediately. There's very little tolerance for performing any activity that requires some time. And that is why the Yuga Dharma for this age of Kali that Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu brought of Sankirtan Yajna is very easy. It's very simple, the congregational chanting of the holy name, as we just did here in the last few minutes. But there is a process, and it has to be done properly, and the mantra has to be given in the proper way through the proper channel of the civic succession. So real yoga, a real self-realization, or any path of spiritual life is actually given by a bona fide spiritual master. It's not that one can just invent something. And what is a bona fide spiritual master? It means one who is in a line of disciplic succession. And disciplic succession, or parampara, is not just start up, okay, I'm a guru and I have my own disciplic succession. No, it goes back all the way to Lord Krishna himself. So Srila Prabhupada, of course, is in the Brahma, Madhva, Gaudiya Sampradaya, which is starting from Lord Brahma. Actually, Lord Brahma was instructed by Krishna on the lotus flower at the very beginning of creation. Then, of course, he instructed Narada, Vyas, etc. And then down to about 1,000 years ago, Madhvacharya was again instructed by Vyasadeva in the Himalayas. And then that line came down to our Gaudiya Sampradaya of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the six Goswamis, on down through many the spiritual masters handed the same knowledge of spiritual life, of bhakti yoga, to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, the spiritual master of our spiritual master, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. And then, of course, Prabhupada has given the same knowledge to his disciples, and since he has departed, those disciples are also continuing the same process of parampara, disciplic succession, and giving that same knowledge onto others. So this is the bona fide process of receiving spiritual knowledge and also receiving the spiritual mantra. I was thinking about this mantra also. There was one group that was, I think they're still around, but they were, I don't want to name names, but they were popular, I remember 30, 40 years ago, and they gave everyone a secret mantra. And one of that member of that group told me later, who left the group, I think he became a Hare Krishna devotee, he said, actually, when we sort of compared notes with one another, we found out we all had the same mantra. We were supposed to have this individual secret mantra, and it was all the same mantra. And actually, it was just one of the Bij mantras or seed mantras, like Kling or Ang, one of those very common mantras that are given out a lot by different swamis and gurus. and it doesn't really have a lot of effect in that way. So it's important to receive knowledge from a bona fide spiritual master. In fact, in the Nectar Devotion, Bhaktivedanta Sindhu, Rupa Goswami's first instructions, he gives 10 primary instructions for spiritual life. And the first 5 of those have to do with the guru, that one should accept the shelter of a bona fide spiritual master, become initiated, obey the orders, follow the footsteps of the great acharyas, and inquire from the spiritual master how to advance in Krishna consciousness. So this is primary. This is the beginning of spiritual life, to take shelter, to listen to the proper authority, not just anybody who has some interesting yoga path or some process that's out there. So one has to really find the proper guide, the proper spiritual master who can give instruction and is bona fide and has come from a line of specific succession. So what is the instruction of the spiritual master? Of course, Srila Prabhupada, kind of there's the do's and the don'ts. On the don'ts, he gave us the 4 regular principles, that we have no meat eating, no intoxication, no illicit sex, and no gambling. But that in itself does not give one spiritual life. That just lays a foundation. That gives us a foundation in the mode of goodness so that we can be receptive to real spiritual life. So the main instruction of Srila Prabhupada was the chanting of Hare Krishna. So every initiated devotee vows to chant 16 rounds a day. And of course, we also chant at Mangal Arati, Guru Puja, at festivals, Sunday, you know, anytime we get together, we also chant the holy name. So this is the principal instruction of a bona fide spiritual master, because this is the bona fide path of self-realization in this particular age of Kali. Why is chanting so important? There are 2 effects of chanting. Well, many effects, but we could say 2 kind of basic classification. First, one becomes purified, and one becomes free or clear from all one's past karmic activities and sinful activities. And second, one simultaneously develops one's love for God. So there's the clearing of our past offenses and all of our past sinful activities, and sort of getting rid of all of that baggage that we come in this material world from lifetime after lifetime, that becomes clarified, our hearts become free and clear, and secondly, then we are receptive and open to understanding our loving relationship with Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And that relationship with Krishna develops as we chant, because Krishna and his name are non-different. Because when Prabhupada once said that when you're chanting, Krishna's dancing on our tongue, kind of a figurative way of seeing how when we're chanting the holy name, it is Krishna, because Krishna is God. Krishna is absolute, and therefore everything about him is absolute. Everything about Krishna is spiritual. There's nothing material or mundane about Krishna. So Krishna's form, Krishna's name, Krishna's pastimes, everything is spiritual. So, you know, we see distinction in this material world. The name and the thing is different, right? I mean, in other words, we give names for things. I give a name for we call it a drum. But in another language, you could call it something else, right? You could call it anything. So the name of the thing and thing, they're separated. You know, it's a well, we talk about signs and symbols in linguistics. In other words, it's simply a symbol system for some, or a sign system for something else. And in spiritual life, there's identity between the name and the thing itself. There's no difference. So when we're saying Krishna, Krishna is there. Krishna is present in that holy name. The power of this chanting holy name is described in many places in Srimad Bhagavatam. And one of the very, very nice stories is in the 6th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the story of Ajamil. And this gives us an idea of the real power of the holy name. In the beginning of the 6th canto, Makaris Maharaj Parikit is hearing from Shukadeva Goswami. But he has this question. Maharaj Parikit says that if one commits sinful activity, there are many different processes of atonement for that, but they don't seem to work. There's a problem with this prayaschitta, or atonement. And that is the desire for sinful activity will remain. you know, and so we see this sometimes, like in some religions, there's a process like confessional. So you commit sinful activities during the week. You go on Sunday or whenever you go, Saturday, I think, you know, often, isn't it? I wasn't raised in that tradition. Saturday, is it? Okay, you go on Saturday, you confess so that you're purified for the Sunday service. Then you go back through the week and you perform all your different sinful activities. Then you go back and you confess those, and this process goes on and on and on. Well, why does it? Why is it that one can sin and confess? Because the heart doesn't change. There's no real process of purification. And this was this is described that when the Vishnudutas spoke to the Yamadutas, they said in 6217, although one may neutralize the reactions of sinful life through austerity, charity, vows, and other such methods, these pious activities cannot uproot the material desire that's in the heart. However, if one serves the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead, he's immediately free from all such contaminations. So the problem is, or the process is, to purify the heart. In other words, if there's not a change of consciousness, simply a change of behavior will not remain. It will not become fixed. So anyway, very briefly, most of you know the story of Ajamil. He was a very Brahmin. He was very devout, a worshiper of God, of Vishnu. As a young man, he happened to see a young couple having sexual activities. He became sexually aroused anyway, and he wanted to be with that woman, who was not a very high-class woman, apparently. And anyway, he ends up with her, marries her, has a family, which is would be okay in itself, except he gave up his religious life. To support his family, to support the wife, he actually turned to criminal activities and sinful activities. And he gave up all of his brahminical and religious life completely, completely forgetting everything as a young man that he practiced. So here he was, a very, very fallen condition, giving up all spiritual life, but he had one great advantage. He had a son from this woman, and he named that son Narayan. Narayan is the name of God. And when he got old and he was dying, he was very attached to the son, very much loved the son, almost inseparable from him. And at the time of death, when he was at the very end of life, his thoughts went to his son, who he loved so much and just wanted to be with. And so he called out the name of his son, Narayan. Now, of course, Narayan is the name of God. And as we've said, God and his name is none different. So when he passed away, the Yamadutas came, the messengers of death, to take his soul away, and to take the soul, and to, obviously, he was due to a certain amount of punishment for all his sinful activities. But the messengers of God, of Vishnu, came and stopped them and said, no, you can't take him. This man is a devotee. He's under our charge because he called out the name of God. And they were very bewildered. They said, what are you talking about? How does that work? How can he perform all these sinful activities? We should be dragging him off to hell. How can you stop us? And it was explained that because he had chanted the name of Narayan, the name of God, even though he did not mean it in that way, it had such powerful effect that it saved him from all of the hellish punishment. Of course, the story goes on. He's actually given, kind of sort of comes back to life, and he has an opportunity then to change his life, perform devotional service, and eventually become liberated and go back to Vaikuntha. But the point is, the holy name is very, very powerful. And this shows some of the effect of it and how one becomes purified by that process. This is also described in the Bhagavatam 1.2.17, Shrinvatas Vakata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtanam Hridantosto Yugadrani Vishnanoti Suritsatam. Shri Krishna, the personality of Godhead, who is the Paramatma, Supersoul, in everyone's heart, and the benefactor of the truthful devotee, cleanses the desire for material enjoyment from the heart of the devotee, who has developed the urge to hear his message, which in themselves are virtuous when properly heard and chanted. Again, we hear this message of the cleansing process, the purifying process of chanting the holy name in devotional service. So this happens even in the beginning. Even in the beginning stages of chanting, has this great power. It's described in the Bhagavad Gita 6:27. Ajamila had already atoned for all of his sinful actions. Indeed, he had atoned not only for sins performed in one life, but for those performed in millions of lives. For in a helpless condition, he chanted the holy name of Narayan. Even though he did not chant purely, he chanted without offense, and therefore he is now pure and eligible for liberation. So this is very interesting. It said he chanted without offense. We know there are 10 offenses against the holy name. We won't go into those now. But if one has material motive when one chants, it's considered offensive. In other words, to say, if I'm chanting, I hope to get something from it materially, or I think, well, I can do any sinful activity, and I'll just chant Hare Krishna, it's okay. These are considered to be, this is not the right consciousness. These are offenses against the holy name. So we don't want to approach Krishna in those ways for some selfish or motivation in that way. So it's described that there are 3 stages of chanting. There's the Namaparad stage, the Nambasa, and the Sudanam. Very briefly, Namaparad means that we're simply still committing these offenses. It's not very pure, it's very elementary. Nambasa is the middle stage, called the clearing stage, and Sudanam is the pure stage. So even in this Nambasa or Abasa Rupa stage, there's great benefit. We could say that many of us are at that stage where we're trying to become pure. We're not purified yet. We're not at the pure stage. We're in an intermediate process. We're in the process of Krishna consciousness, in the process of self-realization, taking it up with some sincerity. So that stage in itself, that beginning stage when one is sincerely trying to chant Hare Krishna, even if there's some fault, even if one is not completely purified, has the greatest benefit. In fact, Haridas Thakur, who's considered to be Namacharya, he is the exemplar of the chanting of the holy name, who chanted constantly day and night, his great associate of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He was describing this process of even how one, even in the Nambasa stage, can become purified. And he said, "Thus worship the Lord, whose name is like the sun. For just as a slight appearance of the sun dissipates the darkness of night, so a slight appearance of the holy name can drive away all the darkness of ignorance that arises in the heart due to greatly sinful activities performed in previous lives. Even a faint light from the holy name of the Lord can eradicate all reactions of sinful life." So this is a very wonderful statement of how the power of the holy name can purify the heart of the living entity. In the same way that the sun, when the sun rises, all of the darkness is dissipated. Now, so Prabhupada explains this a little bit in his purport, in the 6th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Prabhupada said, even in the stage of Abhasa Rupa Bhakti, or Namba stage, all the reactions of sinful life are uprooted and vanquished. Srila Jiva Goswami expresses the opinion that even if one has a desire to commit sinful actions, the roots of that desire are vanquished merely by Abhasa Rupa Bhakti. The example of Bhaskar, the sun, is most appropriate. The Abhasa feature of Bhakti is compared to twilight, and the accumulations of one's sinful activity is like the fog. Since fog does not spread throughout the sky, the sun need do no more than merely manifest its first rays, and the fog immediately disappears. Similarly, if one has even a slight relationship with devotional service, all the fog of his sinful life is immediately vanquished. So this is a nice metaphor of we all find ourselves in this fog of material life, right? You know, we all are covered by the material modes of nature, and we have very little understanding, and we can't see through that fog, through that darkness. But it's described that the holy name of the Lord is like the sun. And just like the sun, as soon as it comes up, you see it's very foggy, you know, and then the sun hits dawn. And a lot of times we have this this time of year, especially when we have these rains. And as soon as the sun really comes up, all the fog dissipates. So in the same way, the sun is like Krishna. So when Krishna and Krishna's holy name appear, and they appear in our heart and they appear on our tongue, then all of this sort of fog of darkness, of material life, of confusion, of misunderstanding, of material desire, all dissipates simply by the rising of the sun of the holy name. So even in the beginning stages of devotional service, this chanting can bring the greatest benefit. And this is described here, it's described in the story of Ajamil, how that can happen, and also in this purport that Srila Prabhupada was talking about the great value of chanting the holy name, and how one who is intelligent understands that this is really the practice that can bring one to the point of understanding and liberation from this material world. And all of these other practices and processes are really not needed. To read the verse again, all purposes served by a small well can at once be served by the great reservoir of water. Similarly, all the purposes of the Vedas can be served to one who knows the purpose behind them. So in other words, what is the purpose of the Vedas? The purpose of the Vedas is to know God, to know Krishna, to know our relationship with Krishna. When we talk about self-realization, it doesn't just mean the self in isolation. It means the self in relationship with God. So that's the purposes of the Vedas. So there may be so many other things that are there, but one who understands that is able to immediately come to the highest stage and does not become distracted, you know, by so many other processes or so many other things that may be there, even within the Vedas. The Vedas talk about everything. They have, you know, knowledge of every aspect of life, every possible process of spiritual life is there in the Vedas. But our idea is that we can cut through those things. And by the mercy of Srila Prabhupada, and by having that spiritual understanding, and by the mercy of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who came and brought the chanting of the holy name, we immediately step over all of these processes, all this confusion, trying to figure out spiritual life, trying to figure out these different processes of self-realization, of yoga, of meditation, all of these things, and come directly to the process of Sankirtan Jagya, or the congregational chanting of the holy name. So a very easy process, but very profound. It's very deep, but at the same time, it's very simple. So, of course, we all encourage everyone to chant Hare Krishna. And as one begins this process, like we're saying, that it's this immediately cessation of all the reactions to past sinful activities. That's there right in the beginning of devotional life. But then one goes a little deeper. Then one wants to become more and more involved. You know, how can I actually improve my chanting? And then one tries to consciously avoid the 10 offenses. One wants to consciously fix one's mind more and more upon Krishna. And so that one develops greater and greater understanding of how Krishna and his name are non-different. And when one is completely self-realized, then one's chanting becomes pure. And one is able to fully understand Krishna and Krishna's name, you know, and dedicate one's life completely 100% to his service. But it is often a gradual process. We don't expect people to be there immediately. We simply take up this chanting, take up the process of taking prasadam, associating with devotees, come and see the beautiful deities, and the process of purification begins. So I think I'll stop there at this point. Thank you all very much. Are there any questions from anybody? Any other thoughts, questions, comments? Yes, Bruce? Go ahead.
When is the moment that a monk can when is the moment that one can consider he's achieved full self-realization, like you mentioned?
What is the moment when one can achieve what?
When is the moment when one can say that self-realization fully has been achieved?
Oh, when one actually becomes self-realized.
Yes.
The moment when one is self-realized is when one 100% surrenders one's life to Krishna. In other words, there's no self-motivation at that point. There's no material motivation. One's heart is pure and all of one's activities, all one's words, all one's thoughts are simply for Krishna. That's complete self-realization. Okay? Go. What happens if you can't chant the holy name physically? You mean, oh, If you're unable to chant, well, then Prabhupada once said that at the time of death, if one is unable to, not only to chant the holy name, Prabhupada said even if one is able to think of Krishna, he said Krishna will force himself into your mind. So that's the assurance. There's no tricks. I mean, you know, you'll be, if someone is serving Krishna throughout their life, and the time of death, they're either unconscious, or, you know, they're just so overcome by everything that's happening with the body at that time, Krishna will look out for us. Krishna will take that conditioned soul to him. There's no doubt about that. Because, you know, the thing is, the level of the spirit soul is really beyond the body, beyond the senses, beyond our hearing and speaking, and even beyond our mind and intelligence, you know. So Krishna and Krishna consciousness works on the spiritual level, and that level will still be able to somehow or another contact Krishna, even if it's great difficulty at the time of death. Yeah, we might not be able to call out like Ajamil did, Krishna or Narayan, you know, but Krishna knows our heart, and he'll be there. Thank you. Anything else? Any other questions or comments? Yes, Ron.
It's difficult for me to understand. You have a personality like a John Mill who's spent so many years in so many terrible activities. And just by chance, chanting Krishna's name, kind of death, it's like a problem of meditation. But then, you compare that with somebody who's living like a very pious life, you know, throughout their entire lives. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, of course, the story of Ajamil is given for emphasis. In other words, it's a dramatic story. It's kind of, and often the scriptures do that. You know, Krishna makes a very sort of dramatic stories to bring home a point. Just like Arjuna is given the greatest spiritual knowledge of Bhagavad Gita. We're on a battlefield. We're thinking, how can this, you know, how does this compute? You know, he's on a battlefield fighting, and he's given the spiritual knowledge. In the same way, we have the example of Narayan, who would seem to be very unfit, very unqualified. But because he chanted, and it's also described because he chanted in a helpless condition. In other words, there was no offense. He wasn't trying to get anything or gain anything. He just, in a helpless way, called out the name of Narayan. Now, the other thing is, one kind of subtlety about the story is he didn't just go back to Vaikuntha at that point. He actually, his life was restored, and then he took up devotional practice. You know, for, I don't know for how long, a couple more years, you know, or whatever it was that he lived. And so he actually did then perform devotional service and lead a very pious life at the end, and then he went back to Vaikuntha. No. But the idea is there that the power of the holy name and how it can purify one of all that all one's sinful reactions. Now, that's not just for Ajamil, that's for everybody. One chants the holy name, it's destroying the sinful reactions. The problem is, most people, we begin immediately after that and you know, perform so many material things or material activities or thoughts are there. So it's a process, you know. It takes some time. Yeah, it's a good question, thank you. Anyone else?
Is it possible to realize self-realization while you are still living in a material world and you are still doing your material duty?
Well, that's a wonderful question. Thank you. He asked, if we're living a kind of in the material world, doing our normal duties, our work, our jobs, taking care of our families, is it possible to take up spiritual life and become self-realized? Absolutely, yes. That is the great mercy of Lord Chaitanya, Srila Prabhupada, and our acharyas, that we have a process that one can execute in any position. You don't have to be sannyas, you don't have to be renounced, give up everything. Many of us are obviously householders, we have families, we have many of us have jobs, and but we simply try to bring Krishna into everything. It's a process that's described by Rupa Goswami in the Nectar of Devotion, Bhaktivedanta Sindhu, called Yukta Vairagya. That means we utilize everything in God's service. So if we can't give up everything, we use everything to serve God. So if we have a family, we try to teach our children. about God and make them Krishna conscious, God conscious. If we're working a job, we do what we can to help those around us be Krishna conscious, and maybe we give some money to the temple or, you know, to, so that, you know, that's very purifying too. In other words, we use the fruits of our work to serve Krishna. So there's many, many ways that a person in this material world can still serve Krishna. And the important thing is everybody can take up chanting and hearing and reading Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita. So there's, you know, and this is something we could talk about more later, but there's many ways in one's own home that one can just take a little time to set aside to read these scriptures together with one's family. I was at a program in Jacksonville last night, and it was very, very, very nice, and I was giving class there, and everybody there was family people, and they had all their children there, and all of these children, there was these four young girls primarily. They were sitting over on one side, about eight, I don't know how old they are, 8 to 12, somewhere, 9 to 12, somewhere there, and they were like asking question after question, you know, all about Krishna and the spiritual world, and they had so much understanding about spiritual life, these young children, and they were inquiring. And some of them were chanting on their beads a little bit, or they were and one of the young girls was leading the kirtan. You know, so even a young child can take up Krishna consciousness, can start, because the process of chanting is so easy and available to everybody. You know, so yes, the answer is yes. In any stage of life, one can become perfected. You know, so thank you for that. Okay, anything else? Should probably end here. Okay, Jai, thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.